Nuts for Sticks is a brand celebrating the manual transmission in all its forms. So forget those flappy paddles because we like shifting ourselves. Check out our fun and funny stick themed shirts at nutsforsticks.com and save 10% on your order using the discount code SWITCHCAST. That's nutsforsticks.com and use code SWITCHCAST.
Welcome back to SWITCHCAST Live. I'm your host, Doug Tabbitt, here with my co-host, Tyler Sanders. We are the automotive news and entertainment show that's not just for car people. Speaking of news, some say that revenge is a dish best served cold. Well, we believe that is also the case with news, right? We're never the first to report. But if you like your automotive news served cold but with extra sauce, we are your podcast. We've talked about emissions on this show a number of times. Vehicle emissions, that is.
What other kind?
Once I referenced something about somebody else in this household that's not my dog and maybe got in trouble for that. But anyway. What?
All right.
Vehicle emissions. We're not talking about Ohio, which there is a bill to do away with the emissions tests in Ohio in the seven counties, which I know we're still waiting on the EPA to sign off on that because we had to do e-checks on two cars this week to register. But talking about a very big deal here, which is California, the Governor Newsom, not my governor.
Well, he's literally not.
Literally not. That's why I can say that. It's not a political statement. It's a geographical statement because we don't talk politics here. He declared, I guess, the same way Michael Scott declared bankruptcy. He put out a mandate that 100% of new vehicles sold in California by 2035 had to be EV or plug-in hybrid. But not regular hybrid, which is just insane. Regardless of your take on the future of EVs, you cannot mandate science into existence. Like, if it doesn't work, if the infrastructure is not there, if the technology is not there, you can't mandate it. Like, this happened 20 years ago in California, and they gave up because they're like, well, nobody wants this crap, and nobody's making it. Now, we've come a long way, but we're not there yet. And there's an old saying, as goes California, so goes the rest of the country.
Well, so I was thinking about that, and I'm going to flirt with politics here for a second, but I'll bring us back here real quick. You know, there's certain groups of people that are very much enjoyers of the fact that states can set their own laws and make their own decisions, and they have some level of autonomy within the federal structure. And this is something that kind of that particular group of people would be happy about, the state having that ability to make its own decisions taken away, but it aligns with kind of that group's political preference. But I do think it's interesting that, while I don't want to be like, you know, there's an exception, I think California has an outsized impact on the rest of the country because of that statement of, you know, so goes California, so goes the country, because they're like, if you look at economies, California is larger than a significant amount of countries. They have a huge impact. So the things that they do can impact the rest of us in an outsized way compared to like what Ohio can do on its own.
Right.
So I think, you know, it's potentially a weird political thing, but my only point is that there is something to be said about like California kind of doing whatever it wants is different than Ohio or Massachusetts or
yes,
even Texas.
True. And there's also a constitutional principle, which I'm not going to talk much about because I don't know enough about, but a state cannot supersede federal law.
Yes,
in their sovereignty.
Yeah, I'm not an expert, so there's probably a bunch of stuff I don't know about.
So the issue with California's EV requirements and their emissions requirements is now all cars are 50 state compliant, but like 20, 30 years ago, you'd get 49 state cars and 50 state cars. I remember with Porsches, it's CO2 and CO3 is the option code.
Oh,
so you have cars that would be emissions compliant everywhere but California. Now, most manufacturers just said, okay, well, screw it. We're just going to adopt to California's requirements, which is what you said. California affected the laws.
Yes.
Not the laws, but the application of their laws for the entire country. A number of other states have adopted their emissions requirements. Colorado and Connecticut are a couple of note. But the U.S. Senate has voted to revoke the EPA waivers that allow California's strict emissions regulations. This is a great article by Car and Driver. And this, let's see, President Trump does have to make the final sign off on this bill, but it looks like, I mean, given his politics, I don't see why he would not sign this. This will undo Gavin Newsom's requirement. And this would be a huge win for proponents of both the free market determining what powers our vehicles and just ICE enthusiasts in general. Mike Spagnola, the CEO of SEMA, who had actually sued California, who sued California a number of times regarding emissions requirements and aftermarket modification requirements and all sorts of other things, said, quote, "This is the United States of America, not the United States of California." California has all sorts of other ridiculous laws, like their decibel requirements, where people have gotten tickets and had their cars like not allowed to be registered because they were too loud and they were literally the factory exhaust. So they would have to go back and like flash them at the dealership and crazy stuff like that.
I did look for an update on Leno's law because I hadn't heard anything about it in a while. Right. And it seems that as of May 23rd, from the California State Senator Shannon Grove's website, it has passed a major legislative checkpoint. I don't know what that means. I'm reading the article as I'm talking here, but it means that it's still alive, it's still moving, and it's moved to the next stage. So that is, it's going to move forward to the Senate for a full floor vote. So
yes, and I believe Jay recently testified in some sort of hearing regarding the bill when they were deciding whether or not they wanted to vote on it. So there are two different laws at stake here, right? So this law passed in the U.S. Senate. Well, it's not a law yet, but this bill passed in the U.S. Senate would affect new cars. So it would overturn California's ability to make their own EPA laws in terms of their own emissions regulations in terms of new vehicles sold. So they can't control what the manufacturers are doing. The U.S. EPA would do that. The context of the Leno's law is affecting used vehicles, right?
Yes.
So California has insane regulations on used vehicles to where all the way back to 1976, vehicles have to meet essentially the factory original emissions specifications. You can't have a 1977 Porsche with the smog equipment removed. It's absolutely asinine. And the reason Leno's law exists is because there's such a small percentage of vehicles and there's so few of them on the road. It doesn't make an appreciable difference in the emissions. That's not the problem. I think like one freight train probably makes more emissions than all the classic cars total. So they're trying to get emissions tests removed for vehicles over 35 years old. And even with that, like it's not a blanket removal. It's with certain provisions. Like you get historic plates that you're only going to drive at a certain number of miles a year, et cetera, et cetera.
But which, something I think is important is that it becomes a rolling time period. Like, you know,
correct.
For historical plates in like the state of Ohio, for example, it's every, you know, it has to reach, I think it's 25 years old.
Yes, 25.
You know, it just makes sense that nobody is driving those daily to make an appreciable difference. We talk about this all the time about how like it doesn't make a difference for the reason that people put these policies in place in order to save the environment. These cars don't make an impact. Go attack something that is a large polluter and should have some sort of regulation or structure put around it to maybe be a little bit kinder to our planet.
Yes, indeed. So hopefully the CARB, speaking of acronyms we don't like, the CARB rules could be rolled back, which is good because 100% of vehicles sold in California EVs in 10 years, just like that's, it can't happen. It can't happen. So, but I think this is a greater win that will have longer term impact beyond this one declaration. California, I think, has far too much power over the automotive market, and for no good reason. Listen, I get it. They have a couple major cities, and smog is a problem within the cities. I'm all for reducing tailpipe emissions within major urban areas, but let's not lie to ourselves about what the real problem is, right? When they talk about zero emissions vehicles, they're talking about tailpipe emissions. They're talking about localized concentration. That is a problem. But mandating that everybody buy new EVs is not the solution to the problem. There we go. That's a hot take. Y'all can argue with me about that
later.
Is
that even a hot take, though? I feel like we've talked about it.
Very much it is. I'm a science denier if I don't think the cars are the problem with global warming and all that stuff.
I feel like it is a very level-headed way to look at this, to know that there is a multifaceted solution to the climate change problem as it pertains to automobiles. EVs are a part of that answer. Sustainable fuels are another part of the answer. Plug-in hybrids are another part of the answer. Like this whole idea that one thing was going to be an easy puzzle piece to just like slot into this problem is ridiculous.
Yes.
We live in a complicated world with millions and millions of cars that are currently on the road, that if you were to replace those, the emissions from replacing them all outright would be catastrophic in a short period of time. That is.
Yes. So, but politicians need to get reelected, so they make these grand
yes.
declarations. Let's see, on to our occasional special segment, things you shouldn't ask on the internet.
Can we make this an acronym? We got fish, okay, we'll workshop it, but I feel like this could be.
That's not it. Somebody posted, I need a car-related name for a baby that is actually cute.
I don't know if you do.
Bentley. Somebody said Bentley is great for boy, Shelby for girl. Chevelle is also fly AF for a girl.
Oh my God, the first guy. I haven't seen this
but
yet.
But hold on. It made its way into a car dealer slash salesman group, which is where it all just went to pot. Because salesmen are the scum of the earth and have the dirtiest minds.
Amazing.
The responses, alternator, such a fire name.
I love that.
PRNDL.
You know, the Prindle.
2001 Ford Taurus.
Oh, gosh.
Somebody responded, I've heard of people naming their kid Axel. I'm going to name mine differential or wheel bearing or some crap.
Oh, somebody used a VIN, but they're just going to call him VIN for short. I love it. Love it.
The setup was all wrong on that. You got to read the VIN.
Oh, sorry. 1FTEW1EP7KKC34787. But they'll just call him VIN for short. I wonder what car that goes to.
Depending on his emissions, would he be a Vin Diesel?
Sure.
My next kid is going to be continuously variable transmission. That's a 2025 joke right there. I kind of like Bronco for a boy, especially if he grows up and offs his wife.
Oh,
I said offs.
You said if they had, been fatalized earlier. Is that like a proper use of that? That's
no,
kind
I
of
just
a
made up a term.
Love it.
If she's a big girl, Chrysler 300.
Oh.
This is car salesman for you.
Like somebody just commented K5. I'm guessing like the truck.
Grand Wagoneer.
Naming my child EV Duramax 2020 or 2535
Panamera is pretty cool for a girl, somebody said.
Oh boy.
Yeah, she's unreliable. Has a lot of breakdowns.
Oh, man.
This episode is brought to you by Sheffield All Sport Watches. The Sheffield brand was recently revived by Jay Turkbus, an owner of an original Sheffield All Sport diver he received from his parents in 1970 when he was just 11, beginning his love of watches. As an adult, Jay used his extensive expertise in product development and marketing to revive the brand that started it all. He set out to develop watches with a high level of quality and specification at a value price. His first effort, and a successful one in July of 2023, was the debut of the Sheffield All Sport Diver 1. It had the kind of build and movement that much more expensive watches use, and his debut price of $108 was equivalent to the $13 his parents paid back in 1970. Since that debut, Sheffield has expanded to a wider range of automatics and chronos, many designed around vintage Sheffield dials of the 60s. The Sheffield well of clever and unique design remains his inspiration, as well as maintaining the goal of high quality, very affordable range of automatic and quartz watches. Sheffield watches, value on merit, not just price. Check out their selection at sheffieldwatches.com and mention that you found them on Switchcast.
Switch Cars is 20 years old as of May 2005.
Ooh, it can almost... 2025?
It can almost drink.
It can almost drink.
It could be imported, according to the EPA, not the DOT. DOT is 25 years. Anyway, I started Switch Cars in May of 2005, so I have 21 years of business in the car. 21 years of experience in the car business, but 20 as owning an independent dealership. About 5 months working at a franchise dealership.
How does that make you feel before any of this other stuff? Like, just in general, knowing that the business you have started and that you have nurtured for, well, this long is 20 years old.
I don't know, because I always thought like I was going to start 18 companies in 20 years and sell them off and be this like serial entrepreneur, as they call it. So it's interesting having stuck with something that long, even though it's taken many different forms as I figured it out and try to, you know, figure out what I'm doing, adapt to the market, whatever. I'm content where I'm at now, but I didn't think I would be still doing this, still being a used car dealer after 20 years. Because at the end of the day, that's all I am. I'm a used car dealer.
Yeah, but, you know, every once in a while, I get to sit in your basement and drink some whiskey with some friends. Talking to a microphone.
With some friends talking to a microphone, whether or not there's anyone on the other side of the camera. But I wanted to share my wisdom. People ask all the time, how do I get into the car business? What's it like being in the car business? Et cetera, et cetera. I'm not going to sell a course. I will never sell a course. That's lame. Andy Stanley or whomever can do that. I just want to share some of the things that I've actually learned, practical knowledge. So if you're looking to be in the car business, if you're in the car business and want to vent with us, I'm sure a lot of you can resonate with some of these truths. But if you're looking to get into the business as well, there's some wisdom here, I think. Or just I'm jaded old man with a bunch of snarling
fist. I do want to ask, I think, and this isn't necessarily relevant for someone trying to get into the business, but I know before I met you, you had a dealership out in Nevada, right?
Yes.
At a racetrack.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds like, to a layman such as myself, as like the coolest idea. Oh my God, you can like buy cars. There's like a track there and you could like buy a car and take it to the track and you can like have track of it. Did that actually work?
Insurance hated it. In fact, they dropped me when they found out what they were covering because allegedly my agent didn't represent to them accurately what they were covering.
All right.
So, yes, it sounds great, but similar to just about anything else in this world, appearances are deceiving and a lot of glitz and glamour. And a great idea doesn't necessarily mean anything. Now, the time that I started it was October of 2008. So not great time, both in my personal life and in the economy in general. The concept, I think, was actually pretty darn good in terms of the integrated experience of I buy my car here, I store it here, I service it here, I come out to play with it here. So we sold a lot of race cars and track cars. And from that perspective, it was actually brilliant. But just because it was brilliant doesn't mean I made any money. My expenses were out of control and I projected too much There you go. There's a lesson. I feel like Michael Scott, right? There's five things you need to know about business. One, I'll give you the rest at lunch.
I need like a whiteboard to write these down as you're coming up with them.
No, but, and this is a general business principle is you don't want to lock in your expenses based on projected growth, right? And that's something I did is my expenses went to like 3x what my revenue was. But I'm like, oh no, this idea is going to be amazing. It'll work great. And it actually did for a little while, despite the economy collapsing. But when it didn't, my expenses were still locked in and I couldn't do anything about those. So the second time I expanded the business after I restarted, I said, okay, if I grow zero, even though I'm buying a bigger building, adding a storage business, I will still be able to cover the nut that I need to cover based on my current sales.
That's good.
Which even that isn't guaranteed, but it's far better to project based on no growth and then exceed those expectations on the income side.
It's a longer term play that I feel like is not, well, I know it's not glamorous and it doesn't get you all excited and, you know, working hard isn't what sells on, you know, Instagram and TikTok and stuff, but a reasonable, slow, long-term approach will usually be more successful.
Right. You could take more selfies in private jets and sell a sales course.
Yeah. I mean,
but no, I just sell cars. One thing I've learned the hard way, because I love being right, is being right does not sell cars.
Are you saying the customer's always right?
No. Not all. Most of the time they're not. But it doesn't matter if they're wrong. Correcting them or being right turns people off, period. This is sales 101. It took me 15 years to learn this because I'm hard-headed and stubborn. And if somebody gives me an idiotic question, I love to educate them. Or if they call me out, they try to accuse me of being wrong, I'm like, no, I'm not. But it just doesn't matter. You just let customers be wrong. You sell them the car. That's just, you put your pride aside and just move on. You elevate the customer. Ultimately, sales is a service business. We're servicing a customer's needs. We're making them feel good, have a good experience, whatever. So yeah, being right does not sell cars. That's a very hard lesson. I learned there's a reason that systems exist in corporate America. I'm a small business owner. I don't like red tape. I don't like regulations. I'm an entrepreneur because I can't work for other people. But man, as frustrating as they are, rules and processes and systems really do work to some extent, and they prevent errors, silly errors that like take a lot of time to correct, and lawsuits as well. So a lot of business owners, small business owners, myself included, like just like, hey, just use common sense. And that does work most of the time. But the more you grow, the more employees you have, can't expect everybody to use common sense. And you have to put in place yes. rules and systems and stuff like that. And
well, and you need to start thinking about like what will ensure that everybody is successful, not just the people with the right common sense or the common sense you expect or the experience you expect. Like, how can we as a group be successful?
Yep.
And it's a lot more difficult to think about a lot of other people with diverse backgrounds and experiences and making sure that they can all kind of play their part in your machine.
Yep. I've learned that truth is less profitable than not truth.
Well, so I wanted to ask you about this because we have talked about this. There is plenty of people on the internet that will kindly excuse certain parts of a car's history in some listings, and it happens all over the place. But I know that you guys tried, you know, to represent as honestly as you can what you have. And that has to be difficult. Like, you probably lose sales. Like, I think it's the right thing to do, but haven't you been tempted at some point to just be like, I can make a lot more money if I do this?
Yes and no. I think that the greater difficulty is not the temptation to be less than truthful. It's where is the line between truth and too much information. Because some people don't want to know, and there's some information that is not relevant. There's people on one side that are like, you should disclose every single scratch, and this was painted, and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, some people don't know and don't care and never want to know because they don't know what paintwork is or what it means. And if you tell them that, then they just get in their own heads, whereas they could own the car for 10 years and not care. Now, that's a sliding scale, because then there's the like people with GT3 RSs who really want original paint and original engine and stuff. And people know that they want that and convince them that it is, or omit details that they know. And I think that's definitely egregious, because they profit greatly off of that. But then there's a sense of, I remember long time ago, I was trying to find a Ferrari 430 for a good customer of mine. He was so picky. And so I found him a great car, but the underside of the front end was scraped, as they all are. And I sent him pictures of it, and I'm like, it's easy. We can touch it up. No big deal. That detail killed the sale, because he couldn't get over it. And he bought a car from a local dealer that does sell good cars, but I guarantee you that the car he bought had the front bumper painted to correct those things.
Yeah.
Or he just didn't look underneath. And so it was one of those things where I didn't want to be dishonest. I knew my customer, but I gave him too much information. Was it material to the condition of the car or the history? No. A front bumper scrape on a low car does not mean it's bad, but he got in his own head and couldn't get over it. So that's been the tough line to walk of 100% honesty, but not too much information.
Well, yeah. And it's like, you know, I've talked to yourself and a few of our friends about, like, you know, pretty much you should just go into looking at a GT3 assuming it's had paintwork.
Yeah.
If you go in with that, you know, it's a surprise if it hasn't been, or, you know, whatever. But like,
or just not care.
Yeah. Or just like, yeah, I'm going to drive it.
Drive your car. So who cares? Yeah. Let's see. Here's a couple funny ones. When a customer says, I could make cash, but... That means, one, either I have a 500 credit score and definitely can't pay cash and won't get finance, or I'm so buried on my trade and I'm definitely not going to pay cash. I've had that so many times. People bring in trades and they're like, oh, I'm curious what you give me for this. It doesn't need to be part of the deal. I can just pay cash. And I give them a number they don't like on their trade, and they're like, okay, well, we're not going to do the deal. I'm like, well, I thought you wanted the car and you could pay cash. Yeah, well, but that number sucks on my trade. Like, but you said they were different parts of the deal.
It's got to be some sort of like posturing. Like, people want to feel like they're capable of just like they need to impress you, almost. Not necessarily because you're some like internet celebrity, but because you are the person that like has this item that they want to purchase. They feel some need to be like, no, I could just buy that. Like, no, it's fine. I don't need financing.
It's totally posturing.
Like, it's so weird. It's
totally posturing. And then they get upset when they get declined. Like, it's some surprise. I'm like, bro, you gave three cars back to the bank. They're not going to give you another loan. Oh, what? Huh? Well, you said you could pay cash. So you want to just wire us money?
I got to move some money around. It's in some places. Like, I don't know. It's so weird.
Yeah. The I could pay cash, but is a huge red flag.
One thing, another thing that I've wanted to talk to you about, I think, you know, I talked to, so I'm in like the software development field, and I talked to some software developers when I was in high school, and they told me that you're not going to want to mess with computers anymore. You're not going to want to like play around and tinker with a lot of things because you do this for work. Like, playing with computers was a hobby for me. I still like play video games, but it's way less of a hobby now. I really don't want to do it. How has that been for you? Because we are friends. We met originally because of cars, and you still participate in the car scene and you love cars and you're passionate about them. How have you kept that when you live and breathe it every day for work?
Honestly, I changed the market that I'm in, and I like that question. You can have a business in something that you love, and you can also have a hobby. The phrase, if you love what you do, you'll never work a day in your life, is complete and utter hogwash. Lie. You can do business in what you love, but I would say don't confuse business and a hobby. Don't be in the exotic car business because you love exotic cars. I did that for a long time. And then I refined the business into lower end sports cars because they made more money. And I separated my passion for what I loved for essentially the business end of the business. As I'm going to run this as a business. So I say, you don't sacrifice profit for passion. You can have a business and something you love, but don't let passion influence profit. Profit come first. And I essentially moved down market in cars, but then I said, well, I'll buy the cars that I'm passionate about with that increased profit. So I segmented my business more as a business. And I said, here's my hobby over here. The cars that I want, I'll buy with my money, as opposed to like pretending that it's part of the business, but it really isn't.
Well, and I feel like a lot of people get into the car business because it seems like a magical way to suddenly have access to all the cars they love and to have a facility full of car. And it could be a handful or 10, 20, doesn't matter. Full of cars that they're like, oh, this is awesome.
Sure. All it means is you don't have to pay sales tax. That's yeah. All it means. Doesn't magically give you wholesale anything. You still got to have the contacts. You still got to know how to buy. You still got to know how to not get screwed. Another thing I've learned, the more a buyer assures me that they are buying the car verbally, the less likely they are to buy. People come in, this is a car for me. This is a perfect car. I'm buying it. Don't sell it to anyone else. Oh, crap. You want to leave a deposit? Well, my credit card, I got it. It's $500, man. On a credit card. This is a $100,000 car. Yeah. Well, my mom and, you know, let's work out financing. I could pay cash, but this is my car. I'm buying this car. No, you're not.
I want to invest it. You know, it makes more sense to invest the money. Yeah.
No, you're not. I'm not better alone. I ran my business pretty much me doing almost everything for a long, long time. Few employees here and there. Some people I worked with that are great. But both in marriage and in business, I've got a great team and my wife is just about always right, and that has helped our business immensely. It helps me focus on what I'm actually good at and figure out what I'm good at, as opposed to just having to do everything. So before you just think, oh man, I'm tired of working for the man, I want to go start my own business, you're going to work for all of the man's.
Yes.
When you run your own business. So, and then when you have employees, then it's like, well, you're an HR person. So just consider that. Consider that. Let's see. Last one. I feel like this is a segment all by itself, or sub-segment, like the wall of shame. We get crazy inquiries over the years. I've gotten much better at responding to inquiries, and I've found that there is now how I want to respond versus how I actually respond. I used to just respond however I wanted and not care. But again, back to that whole, you know, being right doesn't sell cars. We got an inquiry recently, vehicle listed on a third party listing site as a manual, not our fault. We list it as an automatic, but you know, the struggle. You look for manual cars. They come up with automated manuals. Anyway, so the guy says, please don't list automatic transmissions manuals. I highly doubt that you will slide that detail past an enthusiast buyer without them knowing. What's the point of being deceptive?
Because you are making every single like aggregate listing that is out there for sure.
All they had to do was ask about it. All they had to do was ask, and I wanted to just own. I wanted to be like, do you read? If you read our listing, we said PDK. If you went on our website, like maybe you should read before you accuse. But I said, I understand your frustrations. I've experienced that myself when shopping for manual cars that are automated manuals and listed incorrectly. Went on, blah, blah, blah. And I said, you know, here's why the problem happened. It wasn't us trying to be deceptive. And then I said, I tried to switch, flip him, whatever. We do have a manual coming in.
Look at this.
Like more information
salesman.
About it. But then he responded and like just went on. He never apologized. That was my big frustration. I'm taking the high road. I'm not going to say you're wrong. You're an idiot. You should have read. That's how I wanted to respond. But then he never apologized. Like, oh man, I really shouldn't have assumed. I shouldn't have accused you of being deceptive. That was wrong on my part.
It's easy to assume on the internet.
Now I really want to respond to him. Just be like,
resist.
I'm not going to sell you a car because
Ethan, let's hold him back.
Nah. You should have apologized. But anyway,
it is a challenge. When I bought my wagon, I called the dealer and asked them to text me a photo of the footwell of the car because they listed it as a stick when I had seen a lot of automatics listed as sticks for this car. And I was like, I will buy the car at your price if you just send me a photo of the footwell. They're like, well, it's in the detail shop. Bad about it, but it's a paint. You can't trust any site.
Yeah, you can't. You can't. It, which is why I don't trust AI, because if AI was really that good, they would have solved this small problem of automatics being listed as manuals on giant multi-million dollar third-party sites. But if they can't solve that, they can't solve anything. All right. Well, the dealership that I've owned for 20 years is Switch Cars, and the props and flops of the week are brought to you by Switch Cars.
Of course, you know that Switch Cars is the enthusiast dealership where we buy, sell, and consign only cars that we like ourselves. Check out our handpicked inventory at switchcars.com and be sure to mention Switchcast for special pricing. Find more information online at switchcars.com or you can come visit our showroom in Twinsburg, Ohio. We always do a pick of the week as a part of our props and flops. So, Doug, what is the pick of the week?
1993 Ford Explorer.
Unexpected. It's as old as me.
Oh, God. Could be Ethan's dad. 57,000 miles. Burgundy over, you guessed it, burgundy cloth. It's only a little rusty.
Cloth.
And it has a clean Carfax.
I love
$7,500.
I love a good cloth seats.
Yeah.
Cloth seat in a car.
Yeah. No sunroof, no nav, manual seats. Like, this was an E90 M3. It would be the total collector spec. Yes. God. Oh, and side note about the car dealer stuff, right? If you want more hot takes, more wisdom from 20-year veteran of the independent car industry, I will be doing an AMA on VinWiki probably next month. So get those questions in to Ed, to myself, whatever, think of them. We'll be doing a post to get your questions sometime soon. So if you want to ask the car industry expert whatever you want, we'll be doing an AMA.
So, Ethan, you and I got to get some real hardballs in there. We got to make them suffer.
Let's see, flop of the week. And often a flop is something that we're like, this stupid thing happened. We're poking fun at them. This one is just a very, very sad thing. Classic car restoration hub, Bicester Motion, suffers a deadly fire destroying storage hangar. Yeah, this is courtesy of Road and Track. This is a... collector car hub is what they call it. A number of different automotive related businesses all house their companies in this place. I've heard of it a number of times, follow different other companies on Instagram, stuff like that. It's a really cool place with a lot of automotive businesses there. And it was essentially completely destroyed. A lot of businesses displaced as a result, a lot of cars destroyed. And the worst part is that there were fatalities. None of the employees there, but a couple firefighters and one member of the public. So our thoughts and our prayers are with, everybody there. Families of those affected, obviously cars can be replaced. Buildings can be rebuilt, but it's still a very difficult time. Insurance doesn't even begin to start to make right when your business is just gone. Sad time. Our thoughts are with everybody there affected. Something I have bad dreams about happening to our place.
Seriously.
That's a tough time. So in a more positive note, prop of the week goes to Mitchell Corman, who's a past client of ours. He took his Audi R8 on a 10,000-mile road trip from Ohio to the Arctic Circle and back.
Nice.
Yes. So much better than my car. Only has 200 miles and it still has the original tags from the manufacturer in the glove box.
So he probably had to get an oil change up there somewhere, like in Alaska or something.
So the dude is quite handy. He buys somewhat rough cars and works on them, does all the service, fixes them up, stuff like that. The reason we met him was we got a Testarossa on consignment. It was okay. And he bought it from us and he was going to do all the service and remove the aftermarket stereo. But he's since gone through a number of other cars that he's restored. This Audi R8 is one of those. And I got to hand it to anyone who goes out and drives their cars and makes life happen in their cars. His journey is documented well on his channel on YouTube at Mitchell Corman. I won't spell that for you, but it will be in our video notes.
Okay.
So there you go. We're back. Thank you for being with us for season 6. We got more to come. We look forward to spending the rest of the year with you.
Thank you for joining us for Switchcast with Doug Tabbitt and Tyler Sanders, produced by Ethan Huffnagel. Switchcast is an automotive entertainment and opinion show, and nothing we say should be taken very seriously. We do not give tax, investment, legal, emotional, or professional advice, and the only licenses we hold are driver's licenses. The opinions expressed on this show are exclusively held by the people pontificating at that moment and do not reflect the values of our producers or sponsors. Our theme music is provided by Emily and Ivory. You can stream their full album on Spotify or SoundCloud. If you like this show, you can stream it in its entirety on your favorite audio podcast platform. Check out switchcast.live for more info.